Okay, it's Central Time. I'm Rob Farish. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, cash bail reform is a big priority for Wisconsin's legislature to start this new year. Their proposal to amend the state constitution appears to be heading for voter approval on the April ballot. We'll get the details and ask if it will all make us any safer. First, dairy farmers around the state have been struggling to make ends meet for decades. Things may have improved a bit for a couple years, but dairy farm closures hit a three-year high last year. Big picture, since the year 2000, more than 70% of dairy farms in Wisconsin have closed down. With the cost of feed going up lately, some dairy farmers are looking for emergency assistance. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you or someone you know is a dairy farmer, how are things going? If you've closed a dairy farm in the last 5, 10, 20 years, like to hear your story as well. Do you have questions about what's going on in the dairy business in Wisconsin? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Steve Deller is a UW Extension Community Economic Development Specialist and Professor in Agricultural and Applied Economics at UW-Madison. Steve, welcome back to the show.
Thank you for having me.
5 years ago, we were having conversations about dairy farmers, and the story, a big part of the story then, was low milk prices. It seems like things are different. There's a different set of problems now.
That's right. Right now, it's a kind of a return to a long-term trend, and I think what's accelerating it right now is accelerating costs, as you kind of mentioned in your opening comments, things like feed cost, diesel costs, just kind of the day-to-day operational costs. It's just gotten to a point that a lot of dairy farmers are saying, you know, I've been looking at retirement, and there's nobody coming in behind me, so it's time to shut it down.
And we've talked in the past as well about the size of farms and who's being hit. What are the latest trends as far as the size of farms that are leaving the business?
We're still seeing it kind of in what you would refer to as kind of your middle size or average size farm. As we've talked before, there's kind of this what's called a bifurcation. We're seeing growth at the smaller size where they can kind of keep their operating costs down, and growth at the larger farms. It's those farms that are like 150 cows, up to 200 cows. Those are the ones that are really having a difficult time making a go of it.
And those smaller ones, again, we've talked about this before, I think it isn't necessarily that the dairy business is so good that they're, you know, selling milk like hotcakes there. It's they're doing some other kind of work.
That's right. The last time we talked, we were talking about the kind of the role of off-farm income mm-hmm. for the farm family, the farm household. And for a lot of the smaller scale operations, that off-farm, there's two things. One is that off-farm income is allowing the family to survive, the household to survive. And the smaller scale allows the farmers to keep their costs down. So, for example, grazing is one way. So you can kind of see this opportunity at the smaller scale. But the ones that are in the middle, they're the ones that they're getting squeezed.
The number of dairy farms going down in Wisconsin keeps going down. How about our overall milk production in the state?
Milk production has actually gone up a little bit because if you look at the number of cows, that's actually fairly stable. It fluctuates up and down a little bit, but over the long term, it's relatively stable. So what's happening is when these farmers, these medium-sized, average-sized farmers, dairy farmers are leaving, is they're selling the cattle off to larger operations. So the amount of cows that we have operating is basically remaining the same, and the productivity of those cows is going up. So the actual volume of milk that's being produced is actually going up.
So people might hear that and say, okay, it's sad for a farm who's a family who's leaving their farm now, but if our production is about the same number of cows, does that really impact our communities, our overall economy? It's just, you know, the same amount of milk on different size farms.
Well, there's a couple of things. One is kind of the culture and the history of Wisconsin and what we kind of think of as ourselves. So there's kind of a cultural dimension mm-hmm. there. It's kind of our identity. So there's that to think about. But I think the other side is a lot of these large CAFO operations, there's concerns with environmental issues, regulatory management type issues with these. So while we're still seeing milk production at a good level, We're kind of trading off one set of issues for another set of issues.
We're talking about the challenges facing dairy farming. A different set of challenges, but still there here in Wisconsin. Steve Deller is with us with UW Extension and UW Madison, professor in agricultural and applied economics. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you have a story to share about maybe your own farm or your family's farm, what you're seeing in your community, if you have questions for our guest, call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Getting back to the numbers of dairy farm closures in the States, Steve, 2019, really bad. I think over 800 farm closures. Last year, 400. There'd been a dip in the intervening couple of years. What was going on there?
Well, there were two things that happened. One is that through COVID and the federal stimulus money, there was a significant amount of money that flowed to farmers, not only out of the COVID stimulus money, but also remember that when President Trump, former President Trump, started the trade negotiations with China, there was, you know, farmers were at risk because of that negotiation, those negotiations with China. And former President Trump injected a lot of money into the farm economy there. So there was that coming in. Then there was COVID and the injection of money from the Biden administration. And then there's also this other thing is that there is a moratorium on foreclosures. So a lot of banks kind of backed off a little bit and essentially gave farmers and dairy farmers a little bit of breathing room. Well, that stimulus money's gone. And now the moratorium on foreclosures is gone. So banks are starting to come back in again. So you can almost think of it as like a stream where there's water running through the stream. And that's water running is farms leaving, dairy farms leaving. If you put a temporary dam in there or you blocked up the stream temporarily, that flow would go down. But as soon as you take that temporary dam out, there's a surge of water. And that's, I think, what we're seeing right now is there's a surge in the number of dairy farms that are deciding to call it quits.
Now, let's dig into another point you mentioned earlier, the cost of inputs, especially feed. Inflation in general driving up costs for a lot of things. When it comes to the stuff that farmers are buying to feed their cows, what is driving prices there?
It's Ukraine. Ukraine is a major producer of grains. And grains is the primary source of feed for cows and all livestock. So when the Ukrainian war flared up and a lot of the exports out of Ukraine were cut off, that caused, you know, real strong ripples through the grain markets. And that's falling back onto dairy farmers and beef farmers and other types of livestock farmers in the terms of very high feed costs.
You mentioned beef farming. I read in the Journal Sentinel that one factor that's in here is if I'm thinking someday I'm going to have to sell my herd, right now is a pretty good time to do it because the price that I could sell those cows for is pretty high right now.
That's right. That's because we are coming off high milk prices. So you're seeing a number of larger dairy operations that are thinking about how can they expand. Not expand in terms of doubling their size, but, you know, significant kind of marginal increases. So now's a good time to be doing it. If the cost of feed and the cost of diesel and fuels continue to stay high and the price of milk starts to come down, I think you're going to see that that market for buying those cows start to taper off a little bit. So from a purely business perspective, now if a dairy farmer is looking at retirement, they're looking at getting out, now's a pretty good time to do it.
A big issue seems to be not just that, hey, prices are high here and prices are low here, but that they're volatile. They go up and down.
Yes.
And if I'm a farmer getting a market signal, dairy prices are high, I can't just turn the pump on. It takes time to expand production. By the time I've done that, maybe prices have gone down. I'm getting signals to lower production, and that takes time to do.
That's right. This is something, I mean, farmers have kind of ingrained this instability in commodity prices. I mean, they're kind of used to that. Mm-hmm. So they're kind of looking at, I mean, if they're making a decision, if I'm a dairy farmer and I'm saying, no, should I get out now? Should I get out a year from now? Should I get out 2 years from now? They're looking at these prices right now. And they're probably saying now's a good time. Who knows what next year is going to be?
Talking to Steve Deller, UW Extension Community Economic Development Specialist, professor in agricultural and applied economics at UW-Madison. We are looking at dairy farms in Wisconsin. After years of declining numbers of farms, last year saw the biggest number of dairy farm closures since 2019, which was a pretty bad year when it comes to farm closures. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If we're talking about you or your family's history, if you're willing to share your story, we would love to hear from you and the economic issues you're facing, the difficulties if you did decide to close a dairy farm. As a consumer, what questions do you have about the dairy business here in Wisconsin, what it means for the price of milk and other dairy products you count on? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation with Steve Deller, professor in agricultural and applied economics at UW-Madison, looking at losses in the dairy industry here in Wisconsin, leading some dairies across the state to close, others to seek emergency assistance amid high feed prices. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions about how inflation, about how costs are affecting farmers, the long-term trends in the price of milk? If we're talking about you and your own life story, your own livelihood, love to hear from you as well at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We heard Steve from Deborah in Madison who called, couldn't stay on the air. Deborah asks, why don't more farmers have grass and alfalfa-fed cattle rather than having grains imported from around the country and from overseas?
It depends on whether or not the farmer has the land to do it. It also depends on the size of the farm. If you're more of a modest-sized farmer, dairy farmer, and you have the land, you can do that. And we're seeing growth in the number of dairy farmers that are taking that strategy. But if you're kind of landlocked and you don't have a whole lot of land around you, or that land is being used for crop production, it's really not an option for you. Or if you're above a certain size, the mechanics of it doesn't start to make sense above a certain size.
Thanks for that question, Deborah, at 800-642-1234. One thing we haven't got into, Steve, is a lot of businesses affected by this, the cost of labor. What are we seeing on dairy farms?
I think that's another factor that is, you know, there's a lot of things. We talked about, you know, the price of diesel, for example, or the price of feed, for example. I think it's also labor. A lot of these types of farms, you need to be able to hire off-farm labor to come in and help operate the farm. And that's just becoming unavailable. You simply cannot find it. Or you have to pay such a high wage rate that it doesn't make economic sense for you. So it's almost like it's not one particular thing that's driving this. It's an accumulation of a bunch of things. And I think that the shortage of labor is kind of moving up that list a little bit.
I've mentioned a couple times the idea of some emergency assistance with high feed costs. I think Senator Tammy Baldwin has at least floated the notion. Is that something you expect to see happen that is needed right now?
Probably. This is something that the federal government and USDA, there's almost always, when farmers are, their back is against the wall, there's almost always federal support coming out to help them. And I wouldn't be surprised if that happens now, but it's almost like putting a Band-Aid on something that's hemorrhaging. It's almost delaying the inevitable. If this was a short-term spike in feed cost, I could see maybe, but we don't know if these kind of higher prices, how long these things are going to be around.
Talking about dairy farming and the business here in Wisconsin, Steve Deller is with us from UW-Madison. Still time for you to join in at 800-642-1234. As we've heard, a lot of the mid-sized dairy farms closing. bigger ones getting bigger, some smaller ones out there. Does it matter to you how big dairy farms are here in the state? 800-642-1234 is the number to call. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Steve, I hear sometimes from callers, not right now, but in the past, like that there's an unlevel playing field, that the deck is stacked maybe unfairly in favor of larger operations. I mean, is that just economies of scale and the market, or is there something more to it?
It's purely market forces at play. This is the way the capitalist system is set up, and there are favors to larger scale operations. They capture economies of scale. They also, because they're bigger, they can benefit from hiring professional management. They can benefit from hiring professional accountants. All the types of things that make for a bigger business more efficient, if you will, and more profitable, if you will, than, say, necessarily a smaller business. So, but this is true whether you're talking, you know, farms, or whether you're talking car dealerships, or you're talking, you know, entertainment venues. This is kind of the capitalist system, the market economy at work.
If I'm running a small, or involved in a small local rural community, small town, are things different if I have a bunch of small to mid-sized dairy farms in my boundaries versus one big CAFO type dairy farm?
From a purely local community's perspective, you would be better off having one large farm that is paying good wages than have a lot of small farms that are basically poverty level. That's kind of, that may come across as kind of blunt, but from a purely economic perspective, you're better off with fewer jobs paying better than a lot of jobs that don't pay very well at all.
Do those large-scale farm jobs pay in that way?
They have the potential to. Now, if they do or not, that's different. I mean, you know, we talk about large farms as kind of this homogeneous group, and there's a lot of heterogeneity in these farms, just like any kind of business. You have some large dairy farms that are, you know, excellent employers. They treat their employees fabulously. And then you have others that, you know, not so much. So, you know, we need to be careful about making broad generalizations here. But the bigger farms have the scale to be more profitable and kind of ride out rough times, much more so than the smaller farms.
Let's move along the supply chain here. You've said on the show in the past, we think of, you know, the actual production, the dairy farm in Wisconsin. Wisconsin is big on food processing, what we do with those commodities and add value to them. What is that kind of business looking like, from blocks of cheese to cheese on pizza and more?
We're seeing a bifurcation of the market. And one way to think about it is commodities. These are things like cheddar cheese that you buy for a frozen pizza. Okay. Cheddar cheese is cheddar cheese. You want to get the best price that you possibly can. That's one market. There's a lot of growth in that market, and that's the bigger side of the market, frozen pizzas, things like that. But there's another market that is more of a product-type market. This is specialty cheeses. And that market is also growing. So it's very, very different markets. Now, I think one of the things that's happening is a lot of the bigger farmers are kind of contracting with those commodity producers. It's going into, you know, mozzarella cheese that's going on Tombstone Pizza. There it's volume, volume, volume. Pennies, margins of pennies. But when you get into the organic or you get into the specialty foods, there that margin's a little bit bigger and you can get by on a smaller volume.
So do we see smaller, people use the word boutique, but smaller dairy farms saying, yeah, I am supplying these fancy cheese makers, they don't need a huge volume, and this works out for both of us?
That's where a lot of the grazers are going. The smaller scales are contracting with these local artisan cheese plants, and the volume is there. And these specialty cheese plants are willing to pay a premium for cows that have been grazing on a certain type of grass. These artisan cheesemakers can tell the difference in terms of this cow's been grazing on this type of grass or it's been grazing on this other type of grass. And I can't tell the difference, but they can, and a big part of their market can. So that market, I think, is a potential for some of these farms, but it's a different type of market.
And it's a different type of farming. It's not something you could just jump into on any plot of land, right?
Exactly, because, you know, the way that you set up your farm, the way you operate your farm, the feed that you give your cattle, you know, the specialty cheesemakers are all interested in what you're feeding the cows, how are you treating the cows, and that's why these smaller scale farmers, they can fit into that. The bigger scale farmers, no, that's not their market.
In our last minute or so, Steve, what are you watching for in dairy in Wisconsin in 2023?
I'm hoping to see better policies for young farmers getting into dairy. I think part of the problem that we've got is that the number of young farmers that are interested in dairy is getting thinner and thinner and thinner. I think part of the problem is that the cost, if you're 33 years old and you need $1 million to buy into a small dairy farm, what banker is going to give that person a $1 million loan? They're not. Or it will be so astronomically expensive in terms of interest rates that it just doesn't make sense. So I think we need to kind of revisit the policies that we have in place. Wisconsin's been pretty aggressive on young dairy farmers, beginning farmers. I think we need to revisit what's working, what's not working.
Sounds like another great conversation, Steve. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's Steve Deller, UW Extension Community Economic Development Specialist, professor in agricultural and applied economics at UW-Madison. He joined us to talk about why some dairy farmers are facing trouble, a large number of closures in dairy farms in Wisconsin last year. Coming up after the news, we'll check out the state legislature's proposal for a constitutional amendment that would reform Wisconsin's cash bail system. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we all have something to worry about, at least at some point in our lives, but sometimes we worry too much for our own good. A psychologist shares advice on how to manage our worrying habits. Now, Wisconsin's Republican-controlled legislature is moving forward with a proposed amendment to the state constitution that would change the state's cash bail system. If approved by lawmakers this session, the proposal would then go to voters. It could end up on the April 4th ballot. Supporters say the proposed amendment would allow judges to consider more info about the accused when setting their bail. Opponents argue this would, in effect, penalize poor people. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What, if anything, would you want to see when it comes to Wisconsin's cash bail system and changes? Do you like this idea that would allow judges to consider more factors, possible risk factors, when setting that cash bail amount? Or do we need something other than cash bail to take those kind of safety measures? Call it at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. Ian Main is an associate professor at the University of Wisconsin Law School in Madison. He's the principal author of the American Bar Association's Divergent Standards. These new standards were adopted last summer. They provide guidance when considering alternatives to traditional criminal justice system outcomes. Ian, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks. It's good to be here.
Can you talk us through the current state of affairs when we're assessing bail? What can we, what can't we consider?
Yeah, in Wisconsin, it's called a cash-based model, and that's opposed to a risk-based model. And regardless of what model is being used, and different models are used in different states, it doesn't matter in terms of what the state's objectives are. And the state's objectives, regardless of the state that you're in, will be two things. One, that if someone is released while they're awaiting trial, that's after they've been arrested, say, that they're going to appear for any court hearings. And number two, that while they are released, the community is safe. Those are the two chief justifications, and those are universal, regardless of what state you're in. And states do different things to achieve those objectives, the objective of making defendant sure that defendant appears, and two, that while released, that person acts within the community so the community is not harmed. So Wisconsin has a cash-based model. It uses cash as a tool to try to achieve those objectives, to make someone appear and to keep the community safe. Other jurisdictions are called risk-based models. And in a risk-based model, there's no cash involved in trying to achieve the objective of ensuring that the defendant appears and that the community is safe. Instead, used to determine whether or not a person should be released, and if so, what conditions should attach. The jurisdictions look at what are called actuarial risk tables or risk assessment tools to determine whether someone is low or moderate or high risk. And depending on that kind of outcome, the jurisdiction will generally release that person with conditions that are appropriate to ensure that person appears or that the community is safe. Again, Wisconsin doesn't use that model. Instead, Wisconsin uses cash as a tool to achieve those things.
As you see this proposal for a change to the state's constitution, what would change in effect when it comes to bail?
I don't want to be flippant here, but I'm going to be a little flippant, and then maybe a more nuanced discussion can follow. So the flippant and possibly accurate response to that question is, if this amendment passes to the constitution, what change will occur? The answer is nothing. I'm happy, you know, to discuss the nuances, but that's really the response, is
sure.
Nothing. Nothing changes.
Right. Well, the idea is we're going to allow judges to consider more risk factors in setting the dollar amount of cash bail. Why in practice do you see that as not effectively changing anything?
Yeah, in practice, that's already considered by judges. I mean, I served as a defense attorney in this kind of situation, and dangerousness and risk to others and community safety is an integral part of discussions that lead to whether or not there's going to be cash bail and to the amount of that cash bail.
We are talking about a proposed constitutional amendment to Wisconsin's cash bail system. Ian Main is with us from the UW Law School. You could join in with your thoughts, your questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Madeline is with us in De Pere. Madeline, hi.
Hello. I really don't believe in cash bail for people who have demonstrated that they're willing to do physical harm to other people. I'm not just talking about people who shoot their mouth off and say stupid stuff that they shouldn't say, but who have actually, if they've actually demonstrated that they, you know, are willing to do that, like, especially if they have a gun, I don't think they should be out. They use cash bail for a flight risk. Well, that should be not considered at all if those people are really dangerous.
Madeline, thanks for the call. That's that risk-based model. As you said, Ian, not what we do here in Wisconsin, but other states do that. Can you talk about the pros and cons of that kind of assessment?
Yeah, I mean, you know, these distinctions are important, and I appreciate the caller's concerns, and those concerns are shared by a lot of people, and understandably so. As we would all agree, I think, that we want the community to be safe as someone, if they are released or released. If they are truly dangerous, and there's various ways that jurisdictions determine if someone is dangerous, and there is a likelihood that if released, this person will engage in behavior that leads to, say, bodily or serious bodily harm or worse, as in the case of, say, Daryl Brooks, mm-hmm. There are there are in either system, Wisconsin system, whether it's cash bail or risk-based model, in both models, there are going to be rules that permit, under certain circumstances, a judge in the state to detain a person. They will not release that person. They will detain that person through trial. And so whether or not you're in a cash-based model like Wisconsin or you're in a risk-based model in a place like, say, Washington, D.C., both jurisdictions, if there is recognizably a real danger posed by an individual, there are ways to request that that person be detained in a bail system without bail, just detained, and in a risk-based model, just detained. Both situations, it would end up with the same result.
Madeline, thanks for that call. If I'm in this position, I've been accused of a violent crime, I'm being detained until my trial. Could I have an argument that says, well, wait, I've been accused of a violent crime. I have a presumption of innocence, but I'm effectively being punished while I'm waiting for my trial. When do we run into that?
I mean, you can run into that. I mean, if you've actually committed a serious violent crime, and I don't know what you have in mind, and I think this is actually a really important point because when we're discussing these types of things, we have to kind of, and many people have to start with what is the criminal system doing? What kind of types of crimes are being committed? If we look at just felonies, which is actually a real minority number of arrests that are made, are mostly misdemeanors. But if we look at just felonies, of all felonies, 1.7% involve a homicide or a sexual assault, first-degree sexual assault. So the first point being, like, if you say violent crime, and this is back at you just so that we can continue this conversation in a way that I respond to your question and to the concern of others, is what do you mean by a violent crime?
Well, let's say, I mean, hopefully we never end up here, but let's say it's a homicide, but I'm saying okay. I didn't do it. I'm innocent, so why can you punish me in the meantime while I'm waiting for this trial?
Yeah, it's a great question. And so wrongful convictions is always a real concern. And in fact, the state's objectives, understandably, that you would appear and that the community is safe, is certainly on high alert if someone has allegedly committed a homicide. Now, in this situation of, say, Darryl Brooks, Darryl Brooks could argue all day long that he's presumed innocent and there's not a person in the United States that thinks he is, right? And courts and prosecutors and defense attorneys are aware of these differences. There are some individuals where it's based on a really shaky eyewitness. It really may be someone who is innocent, absolutely. And if we detain that person, not only are we detaining someone who is not dangerous, but wrongly accused of a serious crime, but in addition to that, we are making it very hard for that person, however innocent, to defend themselves because it's very hard to interface with an attorney and to be involved in an investigation. And your involvement is very important as a defendant in terms of the quality and outcome of any case. It absolutely would be diminished. And so your question gets to the discretionary aspect and, criminal justice stakeholders, including the judge, including the defense attorney, including the prosecutor and pretrial services, will all kind of make contributions to understanding the particular situation and that are unique, the circumstances that are unique to a particular case.
We're talking to Ian Main, associate professor at UW's Law School, looking at a proposed constitutional amendment that would expand the factors that a judge can consider when setting bail for someone accused of a crime. If it gets approved in the legislature again, we could be voting on this in early April. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, your questions. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk with Ian Main, associate professor at the UW Law School. We're looking at the state legislature's push for a constitutional amendment to change Wisconsin's cash bail system. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts or your questions. Do you think this is a good idea? Are there changes different changes maybe you would like to see made, call 800-642-1234. I want to give a listen to arguments from each party in the legislature. First, Republican State Senator Van Wongard at this week's legislative hearing explaining what he says makes Wisconsin's rules for cash bail unique.
In 2021, of the 117 people charged with homicide in Milwaukee, a whopping 21% were committed by persons on bail. In fact, in national conversations, Wisconsin is held out as an example of what not to do when it comes to bail. Wisconsin is the only state that allows judges to consider only a single factor, whether or not a person will return to trial when setting cash bail.
Ian, your reaction.
That's true under the law. What happens in the trenches has no bearing on the truth.
All right, now let's give a listen to Democratic State Senator Chris Larson, who challenged the connection between a person's wealth and their risk to public safety.
If we are going to reform the system, instead we're galvanizing it in the state constitution to say money is moral. The more money you have, the more moral you're likely to be, the more likely we are judges to be able to say we're going to let you out. Why are we not saying if somebody's a risk, it doesn't matter how much money you have? You're a risk.
And your thoughts on that, Ian?
That is more in line with the thinking of a lot of states who are moving or considering moving to a risk-based model. And, you know, as to be expected, I think the debate, and those are just two snippets, and I'm sure there's moments when it gets hopefully more comprehensive and considers empirical work that really should be informing bail reform. It's not going to happen with the question that's posed for the April ballot. But I think, you know, I would encourage your listeners, and I would encourage, you know, legislatures and people thinking about this, what the empirical studies show. And the empirical studies show that detention itself is criminogenic, that detention itself poses a risk to community safety. This is empirical studies, and it's been going on in the last 5 years. So it's actually new research, and it's important research. And so when you look at low to moderate risk folks who are still, for example, in Wisconsin, being held, 25% of those held in the Milwaukee jail in 2010 were sitting on low-risk individuals and moderate-risk individuals who were sitting on bail amounts of $500 or less that they could not pay. The empirical studies show that as to that group of individuals that we have detained pre-trial, we are significantly increasing harm to our communities. We are undermining public safety. That's the type of discussions we should be having. I understand the first legislator's point about concerns about letting those who have committed a homicide released, whether it's on bail or not. And that's the question that the second representative was asked. Why are they being released at all? That's a good question. But these questions are not getting at real. So I should say there's an additional and arguably just as or more important question to be considering. And what are our current policies? How can they be improved so that in the vast majority of cases that are really creating community harm, can they be alleviated by reducing detention of low and moderate risk individuals? That should be a discussion that's raised and brought up by the legislature.
Let's go back to our callers at 800-642-1234. Dick is with us in Brooklyn. Dick, hello.
Hi. Thank you for taking my question. The speaker indicates that there's really, from a practical standpoint, little difference between the risk and the cash-based bond system. Yet I hear people against the risk-based system say that certain elements of the population will be affected more by that. What's the basis of that argument?
That's a great question. and there are problems. And those problems actually don't go away with the cash-based model. But to directly respond to that question, which I think is great, is that the risk assessment tools themselves are biased and show bias to be against and be more harsh as to populations of color. So that if you're a person who's arrested and you're a person of color, statistically, your risk profile is higher because of your race. Keep in mind, and that is a serious consideration and concern, and it's something that many policymakers are working to improve. But keep in mind, with the caste-based model, that is also at play. Cash amounts are higher for individuals of color in any system. And so those kinds of biases are going to be in either model. What's interesting about the risk-based model is that bias can be measured. And by being measured, it can be subtracted from those assessments. It's still a problem, and I'm glad the caller raised it. And it's a problem with both models.
Do you see ways, and thanks for that call, Dick, do you see ways to unbias either model to take that, in effect, the algorithm that goes into risk assessments and take some of the racial bias out of it?
Yeah, there is a way to do that, and it's possible to do that. You can't take it all out. You can't. And you can't take it out of the discretionary decision in the cash-based model system when you have a judge looking at a person of color and however unconscious the bias, creating a more severe set of conditions or possibly a higher bail amount in order to get pretrial release. On the risk-based model, you can, in a jurisdiction, show on average between similarly situated, say, black individuals versus white individuals, a differential. And that differential then can be subtracted from any individual's risk profile. So that it can be mitigated probably more in a risk-based model than in a cash-based model. But it's going to be part of the system regardless of what model.
Thanks for that call, Dick. We're talking to Ian Main from the UW Law School looking at a proposed state constitutional amendment on the cash bail system. Back to your calls. Glenn is with us in Madison. Glenn, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking the call. Doctor, can you explain why this is a constitutional amendment rather than a statutory change?
Why is that, Ian?
It's a good question. I think because the Constitution right now limits the consideration of bail, the money part, the cash part, to whether or not this person can be incentivized to appear. The question in the Constitution is the Constitution doesn't permit other factors. And so by creating a constitutional amendment that would then allow a judge to consider in particular circumstances in setting the cash bail amount, matters that are factors that are in addition to the question about whether this person is going to appear, for example, the dangerousness to the community, that's the type of change that's being made. If you make that change statutorily, you would run aground with the Constitution right now. And so there would be a mismatch between the statute right now if you try to expand the factors and what the Constitution says right now in Wisconsin. Again, I do want to state plainly, though, that in practice right now, that's what judges are doing anyway.
Thanks again for that call, Glenn. Ian, in just our last minute and a half or so, part of the story here, I understand over the years we've had issues with backlogs in courts, a long waiting time maybe between that initial arrest and court appearance and the actual trial. Is that a factor here? Because it determines how long you're going to be either incarcerated in jail, in effect, because you can't pay bail or out on bail.
It's a huge, huge, huge issue. And the fact that when someone's arrested, they spend time in jail, regardless of whether they're going to be released or not on bail, if that gets your question. And that itself does have a whole host of issues. It does affect really the bail amount, and that's for another possibly future discussion. It also has a criminogenic effect, and so jurisdictions might consider that there are a number of kind of offenses that instead of arresting someone and placing them in jail, which again is criminogenic and does create its own set of problems, that they're given a citation and a requirement that they show up for a court hearing in their criminal proceedings.
Ian, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you. Appreciate the opportunity.
That's Ian Main, associate professor at the University of Wisconsin Law School in Madison. He joined us today for a look at the state legislature's constitutional amendment proposal aimed at changing the way Wisconsin's cash bail system works. You can keep sharing your thoughts on that. Email ideas@WPR.org. And then Watch for your ballots come the April election. Good chance that this amendment will go to voters then if approved by a second round of votes in the state legislature. Coming up tomorrow on the morning show with Kate Archer Kent, the raw milk debate in Wisconsin goes on and on. Find out why some farmers and consumers are making the case for unpasteurized dairy in spite of health concerns that have been raised over the years, and where the state of state laws stands right now. You can share your thoughts. Are you a fan of raw milk? Do you have worries about it? Do you have questions? Get started right now. Email ideas at WPR.org. That's ideas at WPR.org. Then listen tomorrow morning at 8 here on the Ideas Network. Valentine's Day is just over a month away, and maybe you're thinking of a nice little gift to give somebody. Maybe flowers? I'm sure you could go with your roses and carnations and whatnot, but if you really want to up your flower game, how about an extinct flower preserved in amber from 40 million years ago? As reported in the Wall Street Journal, researchers took a new look at a specimen discovered 150 years ago in the Baltic region of Northern Europe. They realized it's a record breaker. It's an example of a flower preserved in amber, the biggest ever discovered, at one whole inch. Okay, that's not too big, but you got to be pretty small to get encased in amber, it turns out. That's three times bigger than the next biggest specimen. The species is called Symplocos kolulevski. It's believed to be extinct, related to flowers now found in Asia. There's a picture in the journal. It's kind of pretty. It's not going to rot and go bad anytime soon. Would a Symplocos kolulevski by any other name smell as sweet? Be easier to pronounce. Flower news you can use. This is Central Time.